Horus Rising by Dan Abnett. Read by Martin Ellis. I was there the day Horus slew the Emperor, he would say afterwards, until afterwards became a time quite devoid of laughter. It was a delicious conceit, and his comrades would chuckle at the treason of it. The story was a good one. Togaden would usually be the one to cajole him into telling it, for Togaden was the joker, a man of mighty laughter and idiot tricks. Loken was always careful to make sure his audience properly understood the irony in his story. It was likely that he felt some shame about his complicity in the matter itself, for it was a case of blood spilled from misunderstanding. But the death of Sejanus was usually all that fixed their attentions. That, and the punchline. It had been the 203rd year of the Great Crusade. The commander had been War Master for about a year, since the triumphant conclusion of the Ulanor campaign, and he was anxious to prove his newfound status, particularly in the eyes of his brothers. It was a strange time to be abroad among stars. They had been doing what they had been doing for 2 centuries, but now it felt unfamiliar. It was a start of things, and an ending too. The ships of the 63rd expedition came upon the Imperium by chance. A sudden etheric storm forced a route alteration, and they translated into the edges of a system comprising 9 worlds circling a yellow sun. Detecting the shoal of rugged expedition warships on station at the outsystem edges, the Emperor first demanded to know their occupation and agenda. Then he painstakingly corrected what he saw as the multifarious errors in their response. Then he demanded fealty. He was, he explained, the Emperor of Mankind. He had shepherded his people through the age of strife, staunchly maintaining the rule and law of man. He had kept the flame of human culture alight through the isolation of old night. He had sustained this precious fragment until the rest of humanity re-established contact. His soul leapt to see the orphan ships returning to the heart of the Imperium. The orphans would be embraced to his bosom, and then the great scheme of rebuilding would begin, and the Imperium of Mankind would stretch itself out again across the stars, as was its birthright. As soon as they showed him proper fealty, as Emperor of Mankind. The commander, quite entertained by all accounts, sent Hastur Sejanus to meet with the Emperor in his high city and deliver greeting. Sejanus was the commander's favourite, a warrior and a diplomat in equal measure. Sejanus's martial record, second only to Abaddon's, was easily forgotten when in company with the man himself. Sejanus, with a squad of his finest warriors from the 4th Company, travelled in system in a gilded barge and was received for audience by the Emperor at his palace on the 3rd Planet. And killed. Murdered. Hacked down on the onyx floor of the palace, even as he stood before the Emperor's golden throne. Sejanus and his glory squad, all slaughtered by the Emperor's elite guard, the so-called Invisibles. Apparently, Sejanus had not offered the correct fealty. Indelicately, he had suggested there might actually be another Emperor. The commander's grief was absolute. He had loved Sejanus like a son. They had warred side by side to effect compliance on 100 worlds. But the commander, always wise in such matters, told his signalman to offer the Emperor another chance. This was a mistake, he reasoned. Peace could be salvaged. This Emperor could be made to understand. It was determined that a 2nd embassy would be dispatched. Malagurst volunteered at once. The commander agreed, but ordered the spear tip forwards into assault range. The intent was clear. One hand extended open in peace, the other held ready as a fist. That sombre day, Loken said, the honour of the spear tip had fallen, by the customary drawing of lots, to the strengths of Abaddon, Togaddon, little Horus Aximand, and Loken himself. In silence, tensed and ready to be unleashed, the spear tip watched as the shuttle convoy bearing Malagurst and his envoys arced down towards the 3rd Planet. Surface batteries smashed them out of the heavens as the burning scads of debris from Malagurst's flotilla billowed away into the atmosphere. The Emperor's fleet elements rose up out of the oceans, out of the high cloud, out of the gravity wells of nearby moons. 600 warships revealed and armed for war. Abaddon made a final personal plea to the Emperor, beseeching him to see sense. The warships began to fire on Abaddon's spear tip. "My commander," Abaddon relayed to the heart of the waiting fleet, "there is no dealing here. This fool impostor will not listen." And the commander replied, "Illuminate him. Avenge the blood of my noble Sejanus. Decimate this Emperor's elite murderers, and bring the impostor to me." "And so," Loken would sigh, "we made war upon our brethren, so lost in ignorance." It was late evening, but the sky was saturated with light. Spectral shapes swam high in the upper atmosphere, ships engaging in a swirling mass, charting brief, nonsensical zodiacs with the beams of their battery weapons. At ground level, around the wide basalt platforms that formed the skirts of the palace, gunfire streamed through the air like horizontal rain, hosing coils of tracer fire that dipped and slithered heavily like snakes, die-straight zips of energy that vanished as fast as they appeared, and flurries of bolt shells like blizzarding hail. Black, humanoid figures paced slowly in across the limits of the palace sprawl. They were shaped like armored men, and they trudged like men, but they were giants, each one 140 meters tall. The Mechanicum had deployed a half-dozen of its Titan war engines. Around the Titan's soot-black ankles, troops flooded forward in a breaking wave 3 kilometers wide. The Lunar Wolves surged like the surf of the wave, thousands of gleaming white figures bobbing and running forward across the skirt platforms, detonations bursting amongst them, lifting rippling fireballs and trees of dark brown smoke. Each blast juddered the ground with a gritty thump and showered down dirt. Assault craft swept in over their heads low, between the shambling frames of the wide-spaced Titans, fanning the slowly lifting smoke clouds into sudden, energetic vortices. It was 10th Company's first taste of mass war since Ulanor. There had been skirmishes and scraps, but nothing testing. Loken was glad to see that his cohort hadn't grown rusty. The unapologetic regimen of drills and exercises he'd maintained had kept them as sharp and serious as the terms of the oaths of moment they had taken just hours before. Ulanor had been glorious. The Greenskin had been a pernicious and resilient foe, but they had broken his back and kicked over the embers of his revel fires. But this was not like Ulanor at all. This was modern warfare in a civilized place. This was man against man, inside the monolithic precincts of a cultured people. The enemy possessed ordnance and firearms, every bit the technological match of the Legio forces. Through the green imaging of his visor, Loken saw armoured men with energy weapons ranged against them. He saw tracked weapon carriages, automated artillery, nests of 4 or even 8 automatic cannons shackled together on cart platforms that lumbered forward on hydraulic legs. Not like Ulanor at all. That had been an ordeal. This would be a test. Equal against equal. Like against like. Except that for all its martial technologies, the enemy lacked one essential quality, and that quality was locked within each and every case of Mark IV power armour, the genetically enhanced flesh and blood of the Imperial Astartes. Modified, refined, post-human, the Astartes were superior to anything they had met or would ever meet. As Horus himself once said, "The only thing that can beat an Astartes is another Astartes." And they had all laughed at that. The impossible was nothing to be scared of. The enemy, their armour a polished magenta trimmed in silver, firmly held the induction gates into the inner palace. They were big men, tall, thick through the chest and shoulders, and at the peak of fitness. Not one of them, Not even the tallest came up to the chin of one of the lunar wolves. It was like fighting children. Well-armed children, it had to be said. Through the billowing smoke and the jarring detonations, Loken led the veteran first squad up the steps at a run, the plasteel soles of their boots grating on the stone. First squad, 10th company, Hellbore tactical squad, gleaming giants in pearl-white armour, the wolf-head insignia stark black on their auto-responsive shoulder plates. The night air shimmered with the heat distortion of weapons discharge. Some kind of upright, automated mortar was casting a sluggish, flaccid stream of munition charges over their heads. "Kill it," Loken heard Brother Sergeant Jubal instruct over the link. The battle brother, carrying the squad's plasma cannon, obeyed without hesitation. For a dazzling half-second, a 20-meter ribbon of light linked the muzzle of his weapon to the auto-mortar. And then the device engulfed the facade of the palace in a wash of yellow flame. Dozens of enemy soldiers were cast down by the blast. Several were thrown up into the air, landing crumpled and boneless on the flight of steps. "Into them!" Jubal barked. Wildfire chipped and pattered off their armour. Loken felt the distant sting of it. Brother Callens stumbled and fell, but righted himself again almost at once. Loken saw the enemy scatter away from their charge.
10th company," Loken shouted, "for the War Master."
The war cry was still unfamiliar, just another aspect of the newness. It was the first time Loken had declaimed it in war, the first chance he'd had since the honour had been bestowed by the Emperor after Ulanor. The true Emperor.
"Lupercal! Lupercal!"
the wolves yelled back as they streamed in, choosing to answer with the old cry, the Legion's pet name for their beloved commander. They stormed the palace. Loken paused by one of the induction gates, urging his frontrunners in, carefully reviewing the advance of his company main force. Hellish fire continued to rake them from the upper balconies and towers. Reports flooded in. Axeman's force, 5th company, had secured the Regency and the pavilions on the ornamental lakes to the west of the high city. Torgadon's men were driving up through the lower town, slaying the armour sent to block them. Loken looked east. 3 kilometres away, across the flat plain of the basalt platforms, Abaddon's company, 1st company, was crossing the bulwarks into the far flank of the palace. Loken magnified his view, resolving hundreds of white armoured figures pouring through the smoke and chop fire. At the front of them, the dark figures of 1st company's foremost Terminator squad, the Justerin. They wore polished black armour, dark as night, as if they belonged to some other Black Legion.
"Loken the first," he sent. 10th has entry."
There was a pause. Then Abaddon's voice answered.
"Loken, Loken, are you trying to shame me with your diligence?"
"Not for a moment, First Captain," Loken replied.
There was a strict hierarchy of respect within the Legion, and though he was a senior officer, Loken regarded the peerless First Captain with awe. All of the Mournival, in fact, though Torgadon had always favoured Loken with genuine shows of friendship. Now Sejanus was gone, Loken thought. The aspect of the Mournival would soon change.
"I'm playing with you, Loken," Abaddon sent.
"I'll meet you at the feet of this false emperor."
Reloading, Loken entered the palace through the induction gates, stepping over the enemy dead. He moved down the inner hall, hearing the echo of gunfire from deeper in the palace compound. The body of a brother lay slumped in a doorway to his left. Marjex, one of the Legion's apothecaries, was bending over him. He glanced up as Loken approached and shook his head.
"Who is it?" "Tybor, of 2nd Squad," Marjex replied.
Loken frowned as he saw the devastating head wound that had stopped Tybor.
"The Emperor knows his name," Loken said.
Loken left the apothecary to his work and pushed on down the hall. In a wide colonnade ahead, the towering walls were decorated with frescoes, showing familiar scenes of a haloed emperor upon a golden throne. How blind these people are, Loken thought. How sad this is. One day, one single day with the iterators, and they would understand. We are not the enemy. We are the same, and we bring with us a glorious message of redemption. Man walks the stars again, and the might of the Astartes walks at his side to keep him safe.
In a broad, sloping tunnel of etched silver, Loken caught up with elements of Third Squad. Its commander, Brother Sergeant Nero Vipus, was his oldest and truest friend.
"How's your humour, Captain?" Vipus asked. His pearl-white plate was smudged with soot and streaked with blood.
"Phlegmatic, Nero.
You?"
"Choleric. Red raged, in fact. I've lost a man and two more of mine are injured. There's something covering the junction ahead. Something heavy. Rate of fire like you wouldn't believe."
"Tried fragging it?"
"Three grenades. No effect. And there's nothing to see, Garvey. We've all heard about these so-called invisibles, the ones that butchered Sejanus. I was wondering..."
"Leave the wondering to me," Loken said.
Vipus nodded and redirected his men. Loken pushed up past them to the disputed junction. It was a vault-roofed crossways where four hallways met. The area red cold and still to his imaging. Fading smoke wisped up into the rafters. The ouslite floor had been chewed and peppered with thousands of impact craters. Vipus had been right. There was no sign of an enemy present. Studying the area, Loken saw a heap of empty shell cases that had spilled out from behind a bulkhead across from him. Was that where the killer was hiding? Loken bent down and picked up a chunk of fallen plasterwork. He lobbed it into the open. There was a click, and then a hammering deluge of autofire raked across the junction. Loken saw the fuming shell cases spitting out from behind the bulkhead as they were ejected. The firing stopped. Loken waited. He heard a whine and the metallic clunk of an autoloader system. He read weapon heat fading, but no body warmth.
"Want a medal yet?" Vipus asked, approaching.
"It's just an automatic sentry gun," Loken replied.
"That's a small relief at last," Vipus said. "I was beginning to wonder if these vaunted invisibles might be invulnerables too. I'll call up Devastator support to..."
"Just give me a light flare," Loken said.
Vipus stripped one off his leg plate and handed it to his captain. Loken ignited it with a twist of his hand and threw it down the hallway opposite. It bounced, glaring white-hot, past the hidden killer. There was a grind of servos. The implacable gunfire began to roar down the corridor at the flare.
"Garvey," Vipus began.
Loken was running. He crossed the junction and saw the sentry gun still blazing. A squat machine, heavily plated and set in an alcove. It had turned its pumping cannons away from him to fire on the flare. Loken reached over and tore out a handful of its servo flexes. The gun stuttered and died.
"We're clear," Loken called out.
"Which way now?" Vipus asked. "We go find this emperor," Loken said. Vipus snorted.
"Just like that?"
"The first captain bet me I couldn't reach him first."
"The first captain, eh? Since when was Garvier Loken on pally terms with him?"
"Since 10th breached the palace ahead of 1st. Don't worry, Nero. I remember you little people when I'm famous."
Nero Vipus laughed. What happened next didn't make either of them laugh at all. The invisibles were waiting for them, and they well deserved their sobriquet. Just 10 paces into the splendid apartments, the first brother died. There was an odd, hard bang, so hard it was painful to feel and hear, and Brother Edrius fell. A second bang obliterated an ornamental table beside Nero Vipus. A third bang dropped Brother Muriad, his left leg shattered and snapped off like a reed stalk. The science adepts of the false Imperium had mastered some rare and wonderful form of field technology and armed their elite guard with it. They cloaked their bodies with a passive application, twisting light to render themselves invisible, and they were able to project it in a merciless, active form that struck with mutilating force. Loken and the others were taken completely off guard. The invisibles were even hidden to their visor arrays. Several had simply been standing in the chamber, waiting to strike. Loken began to fire, and Vipus's men did likewise. Raking the area ahead of him, Loken hit something. He saw pink mist kiss the air, and something fell down with enough force to overturn a chair. Vipus scored a hit too, but not before Brother Taragus had been struck with such power that his head was punched clean off his shoulders. The cloak technology evidently hid its users best if they remained still. As they moved, they became semi-visible. Heat haze suggestions of men surging to attack. Loken adapted quickly, firing at each blemish of air. He adjusted his visor gain to full contrast, almost black and white, and saw them better. Hard outlines against the fuzzy background. He killed three more. In death, several lost their cloaks. Loken saw the invisibles revealed as bloody corpses. Nero Vipus led the way, cutting a path into a towering room beyond the scene of the ambush. His fury gave Lacaster the opening it needed, but it cost him his right hand, crushed by an invisible's blast. Loken felt collar too. Like Nero, the men of Lacaster were his friends. Rituals of mourning awaited him. Even in the darkness of Ulanor, victory had not been so dearly bought. Charging past Vipus, who was down on his knees, groaning in pain as he tried to pluck the mangled gauntlet off his ruined hand, Loken entered a side chamber, shooting at the air blemishes that attempted to block him. A jolt of force tore his bolter from his hands, so he reached over his hip and drew his chainsword from its scabbard. It whined as it kicked into life. He hacked at the faint outlines jostling around him and felt the toothed blade meet resistance. There was a shrill scream. Gore drizzled out of nowhere and plastered the chamber walls and the front of Loken's suit. "Lupercal," he grunted, and put the full force of both arms behind his strokes. He landed a trio of two-handed blows. More blood showered into view. There was a warbled shriek as loops of pink, wet viscera suddenly became visible. A moment later, the field screening the soldier flickered and failed and revealed his disemboweled form, trying to hold his guts in with both hands. Invisible force stabbed at Loken again, scrunching the edge of his left shoulder guard and almost knocking him off his feet. He rounded and swung the chainsword. The blade struck something and shards of metal flew out. The shape of a human figure suddenly filled in. One of the invisibles became visible and swung his long blade lance at Loken. The blade rebounded off Loken's helm. Loken struck low with his chainsword, ripping the lance out of the invisible's silver gauntlets. At the same time, Loken lunged, shoulder-barging the warrior against the chamber wall so hard that the plaster of the ancient frescoes cracked and fell out. Loken stepped back. The invisible made a sucking noise and fell down on his knees. Loken sawed his chainsword down and sharply up again in one fluid, practiced mercy stroke, and the invisible's detached head bounced away. Shots rang out from nearby rooms. Loken walked across the chamber and retrieved his bolter, hoisting it in his left fist with a clatter. Two lunar wolves entered the chamber behind him, and Loken briskly pointed them off into the left-hand colonnade with a gesture of his sword. Loken prowled forward. At the end of the chamber, 16 broad marble steps led up to a stone doorway. The splendid stone frame was carved with complex linen-fold motifs. Loken ascended the steps, slowly. Mottled washes of light cast spastic flickers as he stepped through the open doorway. The inner walls of the tower rose up around him. He had evidently stepped through into one of the tallest and most massive of the palace's spires. No. More than that. He'd come out on a wide onyx platform that encircled the tower, one of several ring platforms arranged at intervals up the height of the structure. But there were more below. Peering over, Loken saw as much tower drop away into the depths of the earth as stood proud above him. He circled slowly, gazing around. Great windows glazed the tower from top to bottom between the ring platforms, and through them the light and fury of the war outside flared and flashed. He followed the platform round until he found a sweep of curved stairs that led up to the next level. He began to ascend, scanning for any blurs of light that might betray the presence of more invisibles. Nothing. 5 floors now. 6. Loken suddenly felt foolish. The tower was probably empty. This search and purge should have been left to others while he marshalled 10th Company's main force. Except its ground-level approach had been so furiously protected. He looked up, pushing his senses hard. A third of a kilometre above him, he fancied he caught a brief sign of movement, a partial heatlock. Nero. A pause. Captain.
Where are you?
Base of the tower. Heavy fighting. Weak. There was a jumble of noise, the distorted sounds of gunfire and shouting. Captain, are you still there?
Report.
Heavy resistance. We're locked here. Where are...
The link broke. Loken hadn't been about to give away his position anyway. There was something in this tower with him. At the very top, something was waiting.
He mounted the last flight of steps, his grip on his weapons tight. The uppermost ring platform formed the base of the tower's top section, a vast cupola of crystal glass petals, ribbed together with steel spars that curved up to form a finial mast at the apex high above. On one side of the platform, its back to the great windows, sat a golden throne. It was a massive object, a heavy plinth of three golden steps rising to a vast gilt chair with a high back and coiled armrests. The throne was empty. Loken lowered his weapons. He saw that the tower top turned so that the throne was always facing the light. Disappointed, Loken took a step towards the throne and then halted when he realized he wasn't alone after all. A solitary figure stood away to his left, hands clasped behind its back, staring out at the spectacle of war. The figure turned. It was an elderly man, dressed in a floor-length mauve robe. His hair was thin and white, his face thinner still. He stared at Loken with glittering, miserable eyes.
"I defy you," he said, his accent thick and antique. "I defy you, invader."
"Your defiance is noted," Loken replied, "but this fight is over."
"The Imperium of Man will triumph over all its enemies," the man replied.
"Yes," said Loken. "Absolutely, it will. You have my promise."
The man faltered, as if he did not quite understand.
"Am I addressing the so-called Emperor?" Loken asked.
He had switched off and sheathed his sword, but he kept his bolter up to cover the robed figure.
"So-called," the man echoed. "So-called. You cheerfully blaspheme in this royal place. You are some impostor, some evil demon."
"I am a man like you,"
the other scoffed. "You are an impostor, made like a giant, malformed and ugly. No man would wage war upon his fellow man like this."
He gestured disparagingly at the scene outside.
"Your hostility started this," Loken said calmly. "You would not listen to us or believe us. You murdered our ambassadors. You brought this upon yourself. We are charged with the reunification of mankind throughout the stars in the name of the Emperor. We seek to establish compliance amongst all the fragmentary and disparate strands. Most greet us like the lost brothers we are. You resisted."
"You came to us with lies."
"We came with the truth."
"Your truth is obscenity."
"Sir, the truth itself is amoral. It saddens me that we believe the same words but value them so differently. That difference has led directly to this bloodshed."
The elderly man sagged, deflated.
"You could have left us alone."
"What?" Loken asked.
"If our philosophies are so much at odds, you could have passed us by and left us to our lives, unviolated. Yet you did not. Why? Why did you insist on bringing us to ruin? Are we such a threat to you?"
"Because the truth," Loken began,
"is amoral, so you said. But in serving your fine truth, you make yourself immoral."
Loken was surprised to find he didn't know quite how to answer. He took a step forward and said,
"I request your surrender, sir."
"You are the commander, I take it?" the elderly man asked.
"I command 10th Company."
"You are not the overall commander, then. I will submit to him, and to him alone."
"The terms of your surrender are not negotiable."
"Will you not even do that for me? Will you not even do me that honour?"
Before Loken could reply, a dull wail echoed up into the tower top, gradually increasing in volume. The elderly man took a step or two backwards, fear upon his face.
The black figures rose up out of the tower's depths, ascending slowly, vertically, up through the open centre of the ring platform. 10 Astartes warriors, the blue heat of their whining jump-pack burners shimmering the air behind them. Their power armour was black, trimmed with white. Catalan Reaver Squad, 1st Company's veteran assault pack, first in, last out. Callus Ecadon, Catalan's captain, glanced sidelong at Loken. The first captain's compliments, Captain Loken. You beat us to it, after all.
Where's the first captain? Loken asked.
Below, mopping up, Ecadon replied. He set his vox to transmit. This is Ecadon, Catalan. We have secured the false emperor.
No, said Loken firmly.
Ecadon looked at him again. His visor lenses were stern and unreflective jet glass set in the black metal of his helmet mask. He bowed slightly. My apologies, Captain, he said archly. The prisoner and the honour are yours, of course.
That's not what I meant, Loken replied. This man demands the right to surrender in person to our Commander-in-Chief.
Ecadon snorted, and several of his men laughed. This bastard can demand all he likes, Ecadon said, but he's going to be cruelly disappointed.
We are dismantling an ancient empire, Captain Ecadon, Loken said firmly. Might we not display some measure of respect in the execution of that act?
Ecadon stared at Loken for a moment, then ordered his second to transmit a signal to the fleet. Loken was quite sure Ecadon had not backed down because he'd been convinced by any argument or fine principle. Though Ecadon, as captain of 1st Company's assault elite, had glory and favour on his side, Loken, a company captain, had superiority of rank.
A signal has been sent to the War Master, Loken told the elderly man.
Is he coming here now? The man asked eagerly.
Arrangements will be made for you to meet him, Ecadon snapped.
They waited for a moment or two for a signal response. Astartes attack ships, their engines glowing, streaked past the windows. The light from huge detonations sheeted the southern skies and slowly died away. Loken watched the crisscross shadows play across the ring platform in the dying light. He started, suddenly realizing why the elderly man had insisted so furiously that the commander should come in person to this place. He clamped his bolter to his side and began to stride towards the empty throne.
"What are you doing?" the elderly man asked.
"Where is he?" Loken cried. "Where is he, really? Is he invisible, too?"
"Get back!"
the elderly man cried out, leaping forward to grapple with Loken. There was a loud bang, and the elderly man's ribcage blew out. He swayed, his robe shredded and on fire, and pitched over the edge of the platform. He fell away down the open drop of the palace tower. Ecadon lowered his bolt pistol. "I've never killed an emperor before," he laughed.
"That wasn't the Emperor!"
Loken yelled. He was close to the empty throne now, reaching out a hand to grab at one of the golden armrests. A blemish of light, almost perfect, but not so perfect that shadows behaved correctly around it, recoiled in the seat. This is a trap. Those four words were the next that Loken was going to utter. He never got the chance. The golden throne trembled and broadcast a shockwave of invisible force. It was a power like that which the elite guard had wielded, but 100 times more potent. It slammed out in all directions, casting Loken and all the Catalan off their feet. The windows of the tower top shattered outwards in a multicoloured blizzard of glass fragments. Most of Catalan Reaver Squad simply vanished, blown out of the tower, arms flailing on the bow wave of energy. Ecadon managed to grab hold of another spar as he was launched backwards. He clung on, legs trailing out behind him horizontally as air and glass and gravitic energy assaulted him. Loken, too close to the foot of the throne to be caught by the full force of the shockwave, was knocked flat. He slid across the ring platform towards the open fall. He went over the edge, over the sheer drop, but the wall of force carried him on across the hole and slammed him hard against the far lip of the ring. He grabbed on, held in place as much by the shock pressure as by the strength of his own arms. Almost blacking out from the relentless force, he fought to hold on. Inchoate light, green and dazzling, sputtered into being on the platform in front of his clawing hands. The teleport flare became too bright to behold and then died, revealing a god standing on the edge of the platform. The god was a true giant. as large again to any Astartes warrior as an Astartes was to a normal man. His armour was white gold, like the sunlight at dawn, the work of master artificers. Many symbols covered its surfaces, the chief of which was the motif of a single staring eye fashioned across the breastplate. Robes of white cloth fluttered out behind the terrible, haloed figure. Above the breastplate, the face was bare, grimacing, perfect in every dimension and detail, suffused in radiance. So beautiful. So very beautiful. For a moment, the god stood there, unflinching. Then he raised the storm bolter in his right hand and fired into the tumult. One shot, the wall of force died away. No longer impelled, Ekadon crashed back down against the blown-out sill of the window frame. He clawed his way back inside and got to his feet. "My lord," he exclaimed, and dropped to one knee, his head bowed. With the pressure lapsed, Loken found he could no longer support himself. Hands grappling, he began to slide back over the lip where he had been hanging. He couldn't get any purchase on the gleaming onyx. He slipped off the edge. A strong hand grabbed him around the wrist and hauled him up onto the platform. Loken rolled over, shaking. He looked back across the ring of the Golden Throne. It was a smoking ruin. Its secret mechanisms exploded from within. Amidst the ruptured plates and broken workings, a smouldering corpse sat upright, skeletal arms still braced along the throne's coiled rests. "So will I deal with all tyrants and deceivers," rumbled a deep voice. Loken looked up at the god standing over him. "Lupercal," he murmured. The god smiled. "Not so formal, please, captain," whispered Horus.
"Garvey!" Loken looked around from his sword drill and saw Nero Vipus framed in the doorway of the Blade School. Vipus was dressed in black breeches, boots, and a loose vest, and his truncated arm was very evident. Loken could still see the scars where Vipus had used his chainsaw to amputate his own hand.
"What?"
"Captain Torgadon to see you," Vipus said. Loken lowered his blade and deactivated the practice cage as Vipus drew aside. The target dummies and armature blades went dead around him, and the upper hemisphere of the cage slid into the roof space as the lower hemisphere retracted into the deck beneath the mat. Tarek Torgadon entered the Blade School chamber, dressed in fatigues and a long coat of silver mail. His features were saturnine, his hair black. He grinned at Vipus as the latter slipped out past him.
"Thanks, Vipus. How's the hand?"
"Mending, Captain. Fit to be rebonded."
"That's good," said Torgadon. "Wipe your ass with the other one for a while. Carry on."
Vipus laughed and disappeared. Torgadon chuckled at his own quip and climbed the short steps to face Loken in the middle of the canvas mat. He paused at a blade rack outside the open cage, selected a long-handled axe, and drew it out, hacking the air with it as he advanced.
"Hello, Garviel," he said. "You've heard the rumour, I suppose."
"I've heard all sorts of rumours, sir."
"I mean, the one about you. Take a guard."
Loken tossed his practice blade into the deck and quickly drew a tabar from the nearest rack. It was all steel, and the cutting edge of the axe head had a pronounced curve. He raised it in a hunting stance and took up position facing Torgadon. Torgadon fainted, then smote in with two furious chops. Loken deflected the blow, and the Blade School rang with chiming echoes.
"So, this rumour," he continued, circling.
"This rumour," Loken nodded, "is it true?"
"No," said Torgadon. Then he grinned impishly. "Of course it bloody is." He laughed loudly at the mischief.
"That's funny," said Loken.
"Oh, belt up and smile," Torgadon hissed, and scythed in again, striking at Loken with two very non-standard crosswings that Loken had trouble dodging. He was forced to spin his body out of the way and land with his feet wide braced.
"Interesting work," Loken said. "Are you just making these moves up?"
Torgadon grinned.
"Taught to me by the War Master himself," he said. pacing around and allowing the long axe to spin in his fingers. The blade flashed in the glow of the downlighters aimed on the canvas. He halted suddenly and aimed the head of the axe at Loken.
"Don't you want this, Garviel? I put you up for this myself."
"I'm honoured, sir. I thank you for that."
Torgadon raised a finger for silence. "Abaddon seconded you for this."
"The first captain?"
Torgadon nodded. "He was impressed. You beat him to the punch. Glory to Tenth. And the vote was decided by the War Master."
Loken lowered his guard completely.
"The War Master?
He wants you in. Told me to tell you that himself. He appreciated your work. He admired your sense of honour."
"Did he?"
"No." Loken looked up. Torgadon was coming at him with his axe high and whirling. Loken ducked, sidestepped, and thumped the butt of his tabard's haft into Torgadon's side, causing Torgadon to misstep and stumble. Torgadon exploded in laughter. "Yes, yes, he did. Terra, you're too easy, Garvey. The look on your face."
Loken smiled thinly. Torgadon looked at the axe in his hand and then tossed it aside, as if suddenly bored with the whole thing. It landed with a clatter in the shadows off the mat.
"So, what do you say?" Torgadon asked. "What do I tell them? Are you in?"
"Sir, it would be the finest honour of my life," Loken said.
Torgadon nodded and smiled.
"Yes, it would," he said. "And here's your first lesson. You call me Taric."
It was said that the iterators were selected via a process even more rigorous and scrupulous than the induction mechanisms of the Astartes. To be an iterator, a person had to have certain rare gifts that belied enhancement: insight, articulacy, political genius, keen intelligence. The latter could be boosted either digitally or pharmaceutically, and a mind could be tutored in history, ethic, politics, and rhetoric. A person could be taught what to think, but he couldn't be taught how to think. Loken loved to watch the iterators at work, and Kirill Sinderman was the finest iterator Loken had ever seen. Sinderman held the post of primary iterator in the 63rd expedition and was responsible for the shaping of the message. He had, it was well known, a deep and intimate friendship with the War Master, as well as the Expedition Master and the Senior Equerries, and his name was known by the Emperor himself. Sinderman was finishing a briefing in the School of Iterators when Loken strayed into the audience hall, a long vault set deep in the belly of the vengeful spirit. 2,000 men and women, each dressed in simple robes, sat in the banks of tiered seating, rapt by his every word.
"To sum up," Sinderman was saying, "this recent episode allows us to observe genuine blood and sinew beneath the wordy skin of our philosophy. The truth we convey is the truth, because we say it is the truth. Is that enough?" He shrugged. "I don't believe so. My truth is better than your truth is a schoolyard squabble, not the basis of a culture. I am right, so you are wrong, is a syllogism that collapses as soon as one applies any of a number of fundamental ethical tools. I am right, ergo you are wrong. We can't construct a constitution on that, and we cannot, should not, will not be persuaded to iterate on its basis. It would make us what?"
He looked out across his audience. A number of hands were raised.
"There."
"Liars."
Sinderman smiled. "I was thinking bullies or demagogues, but liars is apt. Well done, liars. That is the one thing we iterators can never allow ourselves to become."
Sinderman took a sip of water before continuing. Loken at the back of the hall sat down in an empty seat. Sinderman was tall for a non-Astartes, his patrician head crowned by fine white hair. His eyebrows were black, like the chevron markings on a Lunar Wolf shoulder plate. He had a commanding presence, but it was his voice that really mattered, a soft, clean voice that communicated reason and sincerity and trust. It was a voice worth searching through 100,000 people to find. Sinderman continued.
"Great actions have shaped our society.
The greatest of these, physically, has been the Emperor's Unification of Terror, the outward sequel to which this great crusade we are now engaged upon. But the greatest, intellectually, has been our casting off of that heavy mantle called religion. A religion damned our species for thousands of years. It drove us to madness, to war, to murder. It hung upon us like a disease, like a shackle ball. I'll tell you what religion was. Ignorance. Since the earliest times, our species has striven to understand the workings of the cosmos, and where that understanding has failed, we have filled in the gaps with blind faith. Why does the sun go round the sky? I don't know. So I will attribute it to the efforts of a sun god with a golden chariot. Why do people die? I can't say, but I will choose to believe it is the murky business of a reaper who carries souls to some afterworld. His audience laughed. Cinderman got down off his podium and walked to the front steps of the stage, beyond the range of the vox mics. Though he dropped his voice low, its trained pitch carried his words throughout the chamber. Religious faith existed to make us all more comfortable and content in the face of a measureless cosmos. They were bolsters for the soul, crutches for the intellect, prayers and lucky charms to help us through the darkness. But we have witnessed the cosmos now. We have seen the stars from behind and found they have no golden chariots carrying them abroad. We have realized there is no need for gods, and by extension, no use any longer for demons or spirits. The greatest thing mankind ever did was to reinvent itself as a secular culture. His audience applauded this wholeheartedly. Cinderman turned away as if finished, and then swung back again as the clapping petered out, his voice even softer and more penetrating. But what of faith? Faith has a quality, even when religion has gone. We still need to believe in something, don't we? Here it is. The true purpose of mankind is to bear the torch of truth aloft and shine it, even into the darkest places, to share our understanding with the dimmest reaches of the cosmos, to emancipate those shackled in ignorance, to free ourselves and others from false gods, and take our place at the apex of sentient life. That is what we may pour faith into. That is what we can harness our boundless faith to. More cheers and clapping. These last months we have quashed an entire culture, broken their backs, set them to flame. I know this because I know the War Master unleashed his Astartes in this action. Don't be coy about what they do. They are killers, but sanctioned. I see one now, one noble warrior seated at the back of the hall. Faces turned back to Crane at Loken. There was a flutter of applause. Cinderman started clapping furiously. He deserves better than that. A huge peal of clapping rose to the roof of the hall. Loken stood and took it with an embarrassed bow. The applause died away. The souls we have lately conquered believed in an imperium, a rule of man, Cinderman said. Nevertheless, we killed their emperor and forced them into submission. We burned their cities and scuppered their warships. Is all we have to say in response to their why a feeble, I am right, so you are wrong? He looked down, as if in thought. Yet we are right. They are wrong. Why? Not because we say so, because we know so. We will not say, I am right, and you are wrong, because we have bested them in combat. We must proclaim it because we know it is the responsible truth. We will not promulgate that idea for any other reason than we know that it is the truth, and upon that truth we bestow our faith. They are wrong. Their culture was constructed upon lies. We have brought them the keen edge of truth and enlightened them. On that basis alone, go from here and iterate our message."
He had to wait, smiling until the uproar subsided.
"Dismissed!"
The student iterators began to file slowly out of the hall. Cinderman walked up the steps from the stage to where Loken was seated.
"Did you hear anything you liked?" he asked, sitting down beside Loken.
"You sounded like a carnival peddler," Loken said.
Cinderman crooked an eyebrow.
"Sometimes, Garviel, that's precisely how I feel."
Loken frowned.
"That you don't believe what you're selling."
"Do you?"
"What am I selling?"
"Faith through murder, truth through combat."
"It's just combat. The meaning has been decided long before I'm instructed to deliver it."
"So, as a warrior, you are without conscience."
Loken shook his head.
"As a warrior, I am a man of conscience, and that conscience is directed by my faith in the Emperor. When activated for war, I set aside my personal considerations and simply act. The value of my action has already been weighed by the greater conscience of our commander. I kill until I am told to stop, and I do not question the killing. The commander has already made a determination for war, and all he expects of me is to prosecute it to the best of my abilities. A weapon doesn't question who it kills or why. That isn't the point of weapons."
Cinderman smiled. "No, it's not, and that's how it should be. I'm curious, though. I didn't think we had a tutorial schedule for today."
Beyond their duties as iterators, senior counselors like Cinderman were expected to conduct programs of education for the Astartes. This had been ordered by the War Master himself. The men of the Legion spent long periods in transit between wars, and the War Master insisted they use the time to develop their minds and expand their knowledge.
"There will come a time when war is over," he had said, "and my warriors should prepare themselves for a life of peace."
"There's no tutorial scheduled," Loken said, "but I wanted to talk with you informally."
"You have been asked to join the Mournival," Cinderman said.
Loken blinked.
How did you know? Does everyone know?"
Cinderman grinned.
"Sir Janus is gone. The Mournival lacks. Are you surprised they came to you?"
"I am."
"I am not. The War Master has his eye on you. So does Dorn."
"Primarch Dorn, are you sure?"
"I have been told he admires your phlegmatic humour, Garviel."
"I'm flattered."
"You should be. Now, what's the problem?"
"Could we not have just left them alone?"
"Who?"
"These people, this Emperor."
"Garviel, you know the answer to that."
"When I was in the tower facing the Emperor, he said much the same thing. Quartz, from his quantifications, teaches us that the galaxy is a broad space, and that much I have seen. If we encounter a person, a society in this cosmos that disagrees with us, but is sound of itself, what right do we have to destroy it? Could we just not leave them be?"
"This has clearly played on your mind. Why haven't you spoken to me about it before?" Cinderman said.
"I thought it would fade," Loken admitted.
Cinderman rose to his feet and beckoned Loken to follow him. They walked out of the audience chamber and along one of the great spinal hallways of the flagship, an arch-roofed, buttressed canyon 3 decks high, like the nave of an ancient cathedral fane, elongated to a length of 5 kilometres. Tides of personnel streamed along the hallway, and Loken could see other flows of foot traffic in the illuminated galleries above.
"The first thing," Cinderman said as they strolled along, "is a simple bandage for your worries. You ventured a version of it just a moment ago when you spoke on the subject of conscience. You are a weapon, Garviel, an example of the finest instrument of destruction mankind has ever wrought. There must be no place inside you for doubt or question. Weapons should not think. They should only allow themselves to be employed, for the decision to use them is not theirs to make. That decision must be made by the Primarchs and the Commanders.
The War Master, like the beloved Emperor before him, does not employ you lightly. The Adeptus Astartes is the last resort, and is only ever used that way.
Loken nodded.
This is what you must remember. We have developed warriors like you because it is necessary. Right does not follow might. Mankind has a great empirical truth to convey for the good of all. Sometimes that message falls on unwilling ears. Sometimes that message is spurned and denied, as here. Then, and only then, thank the stars that we own the might to enforce it. We are mighty because we are right, Garfield. We are not right because we are mighty. Vile the hour when that reversal becomes our credo.
They had turned off the spinal hallway and were walking along a lateral promenade now towards the archive annex. Whether our truth is right or not, must we always enforce it upon the unwilling?
You are walking along the shores of a lake, Cinderman said. A boy is drowning. Do you let him drown because he was foolish enough to fall into the water before he had learnt to swim? Or do you fish him out?
Loken shrugged. The latter.
What if he fights you off as you attempt to save him, because he is afraid of you?
I save him anyway.
They had stopped walking. Cinderman pressed his hand to the keyplate set into the brass frame of a huge door, and allowed his palm to be read by the scrolling light. The door opened, gusting out climate-controlled air and a background hint of dust. They stepped into the vault of Archive Chamber 3. Scholars, sphragists, and metaphrasts worked in silence at the reading desks.
"What interests me about your concerns," Cinderman said, "is what they say about you. We have established you are a weapon, and that you don't need to think about what you do, because the thinking is done for you. Yet you retain the ability to consider the cosmos as a man would, not as an instrument might."
"I see," Loken replied. "You're saying I have forgotten my place."
"Oh, no," Cinderman smiled. "I'm saying you have found your place."
"How so?" Loken asked.
"What is the Mournival, Garviel?"
Cinderman whispered. "It is an informal honor. Since the earliest era of our legion, there has been a Mournival. For captains, those regarded by their peers to be..." He paused.
"The best?" Cinderman asked.
"My modesty is ashamed to use that word. The most appropriate. At any time, the Legion, in an unofficial manner quite separate from the chain of command, composes a Mournival, a confraternity of four captains who act as the soul of the Legion."
"And their job is to watch over the moral health of the Legion, to guide and shape its philosophy, and, most important of all, to be the comrades and friends the commander can turn to privately and talk out his concerns and troubles with freely, before they ever become matters of state or council."
"That is what the Mournival is supposed to do," Loken agreed.
"Then it occurs to me, Garfiel, that only a weapon which questions its use could be of any value in that role. Do you know what a naysmith is?"
"No."
"In early Terran history, naysmiths were employed by the ruling classes. Their job was to disagree, to consider any argument or policy and find fault with it. They were highly valued."
"You want me to become a naysmith?" Loken asked.
Cinderman shook his head. "I want you to be you, Garviel. The Mournival needs your common sense and clarity, the balance between Abaddon's choler and Axemon's disdain. The War Master needs that balance now more than ever. You came to me this morning because you wanted to know if you should accept the honour. By the merit of your own doubts, you have answered your own question."
Beyond the high hedge, an ornamental water garden lay in shadowy ruin. The height of the hedge and the neighbouring trees screened out what was left of the direct sunlight.
The garden had once been composed of rectangular house-like slabs laid like giant flagstones, surrounding a series of square, shallow basins where lilies and bright waterflowers had flourished in pebbly sinks fed by some spring or water source. During the assault of the high city, shells had bracketed the area, felling many of the plants and shattering a great number of the blocks. Many of the house-like slabs had been dislodged, and several of the pools greatly increased in breadth and depth by the addition of deep craters. But the hidden spring had continued to feed the place, filling the shell holes and overflowing between dislodged stones. Some of the intact blocks, slabs 2 meters long and half a meter thick, had been rearranged, and not randomly by the blasts. They had been levered out to form a walkway into the pool area, a stone jetty sunk almost flush with the water's surface. Loken stepped out onto the causeway and began to follow it. The air smelled damp, and he could hear the clack of amphibians and the hiss of evening flies. Loken felt no fear, but he registered a trepidation that made his heart beat. He was about to pass a threshold in his life, and he held faith that whatever lay beyond would be provident. It also felt right that he was about to take a profound step forward in his career. His world had changed greatly of late, with the rise of the War Master and the consequent alteration of the Crusade, and it was only proper that he changed with it. A new phase, a new time. He paused and looked up at the stars that were beginning to light in the purpling sky. A new time, and a glorious new time at that. Like him, mankind was on a threshold, about to step forward into greatness. The causeway path came to an end. Water gleamed beyond. Ahead, across 30 meters of still pond, a little bank of weeping trees rose up like an atoll. He wondered if he should wait. Then he saw a flicker of light amongst the trees across the water, a flutter of yellow flame that went as quickly as it came. Loken stepped off the causeway into the water. It was shin-deep. Ripples, hard black circles, radiated out across the reflective pool. He began to wade out towards the islet, hoping that his feet wouldn't suddenly encounter some unexpected depth of submerged crater and so lend comedy to this solemn moment. He reached the bank of trees and stood in the shallows, gazing up into the tangled blackness. "Give us your name," a voice called out of the darkness. "Garviel Loken." "And what is your honour?" "I am captain of the 10th Company of the 16th Legio Astartes." "And who is your sworn master?" "The War Master and the Emperor both." Silence followed, interrupted only by the splash of frogs and the noise of insects in the waterlogged thickets. The voice spoke again. "Illuminate him." There was a brief metallic scrape as the slot of a lantern was pulled open, and yellow flame light shone out across him. Three figures stood on the tree-lined bank above him, one holding the lantern up. Axamund, Torgadon lifting the lantern, Abaddon. Like him, they wore their armour, the dancing light catching bright off the curves of the plate. All were bareheaded. "Do you vouch that this soul is all he claims to be?" Abaddon asked. It seemed a strange question, as all three of them knew him well enough. Loken understood it was part of the ceremony. "I so vouch," Torgadon said. "Increase the light." Abaddon and Axamund stepped away and began to open the slots of a dozen other lanterns hanging from the surrounding boughs. When they had finished, a golden light suffused them all. The trio stepped forward into the water to face Loken. Tarek Togadon was the tallest of them, his trickster grin never leaving his face. "Loosen up, Garvey," he chuckled. "We don't bite." Loken flashed a smile, but he felt unnerved. Partly, it was the high status of these three men, but he also hadn't expected the induction to be so ritualistic. Horus Axamund, captain of 5th Company, was the youngest and shortest of them. His head was shaved smooth and oiled, so that the lamplight gleamed off it. Axamund, like many in the younger generations of the Legion, had been named in honour of the commander, but only he used the name openly. His noble face uncannily resembled the visage of the War Master, and this had earned him the affectionate name Little Horus, the devil dog in war, the master strategist. He nodded greeting to Loken. Ezekiel Abaddon, first captain of the Legion, like Torgadon, had been in the Mournival from its inception. He, like Torgadon and Axemon both, shared the same aspect of straight nose and wide-spaced eyes so reminiscent of the Warmaster, though only in Axemon were the features an actual likeness. They might have been brothers if they had been sired in the normal way. As it was, they were siblings in terms of gene source and martial fraternity. Now Loken was to be their brother too. There was a curious incidence in the Lunar Wolves' Legion of Astartes bearing a facial resemblance to their Primarch. This had been put down to conformities in the gene seed, but still, those who echoed Horus in their features were considered especially lucky and were known by all the men as the Sons of Horus. It was a mark of honour, and it often seemed the case that sons rose faster and found better favour than the rest. Certainly, Loken knew for a fact all the previous members of the Mournival had been Sons of Horus. In this respect, he was unique. He was the first non-son to be elected to this elite inner circle. Though he knew it couldn't be the case, he felt as if he had achieved this eminence through simple merit, rather than the atavistic whim of physiognomy. "This is a simple act," Abaddon said, regarding Loken. "You have been vouched for here and proposed by great men before that. Our Lord and the Lord Dawn both put your name forward, as did I."
"Thank you, sir," Loken said.
"A first lesson, then," Abaddon said. "In the Mournival, we are equals. There is no rank. Before the men, you may refer to me as Sir or First Captain, but between us, there is no ceremony. I am Ezekiel."
"Horus," said Axemond.
"Tarek," said Torgadon. "I understand," Loken answered. "Ezekiel."
"The rules of our confraternity are simple," Axemon said, "and we will get to them, but there is no structure to the duties expected of you. You should prepare yourself to spend more time with the command staff and function at the War Master's side."
"There will be other duties and obligations too," Abaddon said. "Are you sanguine about that? Your life will change."
"I am sanguine," Loken nodded.
"Then we should mark you in," Abaddon said. They strode out into the black water and formed a ring. Abaddon bade them stand stock still until the water ceased to lap and ripple. It became mirror smooth. The bright reflection of the rising moon wavered on the water between them. "The one fixture that has always witnessed an induction," Abaddon said. "The moon. Symbolic of our legion name. No one has ever entered the Mournival except by the light of a moon." Loken nodded.
"This seems a poor false one," Axemond muttered, looking up at the sky. "But it will do. The image of the moon must always be reflected. In the first days of the Mournival, close on 200 years ago, it was favoured to have the chosen moon's image captured in a scrying dish or polished mirror. We make do now. Water suffices."
Loken nodded again. His feeling of being unnerved had returned. This was a ritual, and it smacked dangerously of the practices of corpse whisperers and spiritualists, the sort of superstitious unreason Cinderman had taught him to rail against. He felt he had to say something before it was too late.
"I am a man of faith," he said, softly, "and that faith is the truth of the Imperium. I will not bow to any fane or acknowledge any spirit. I own only the empirical clarity of imperial truth."
The other three looked at him. "I told you he was straight up and down," Torgadon said. Abaddon and Axemond laughed. "There are no spirits here," Abaddon said, resting a hand reassuringly against Loken's arm.
"We're not trying to ensorcel you. We want this moment to be special to you," Axemond said. "We want you to remember it. We believe it's important to mark an induction with a sense of ceremony and occasion, so we use the old ways."
"I understand," Loken said.
"Do you?" Abaddon asked. "You're going to make a pledge to us, an oath as firm as any oath of moment you have ever undertaken, man to man, cold and clear, and very, very secular. An oath of brothership, not some occult pact. We stand together in the light of a moon and swear a bond that only death will break."
"I understand," Loken repeated. He felt foolish. "I want to take the oath."
Abaddon nodded. "Let's mark you in, then.
Say the names of the others. Togadon bowed his head and recited 9 names. Since the foundation of the Morneval, only 12 men had held the unofficial rank, and 3 of those were present. Loken would be the 13th. Keeshan, Minos, Barabadon, Letus, Sirikul, Diradadon, Caradon, Janipur, Sejanus. Lost in glory, Axamund and Abaddon said as one voice. Mourned by the Morneval, only in death does duty end. A bond that only death will break, Loken thought about Abaddon's words. Death was the single expectation of each and every Astartes. Violent death. It was not an if, it was a when. In the service of the Imperium, each of them would eventually sacrifice his life. They were phlegmatic about it. It would happen. It was that simple. One day, it would happen. There was an irony, of course. Age would not wither the Astartes. They would live forever. 5,000 years, 10,000, beyond even that, into some unimaginable millennium, except for the scythe of war. Immortal, but not invulnerable. They might live forever, but they would never get the chance. Immortality was a byproduct of their Astartes strengths, but those strengths had been gene-built for combat. They had been born immortal only to die in war. Brief, bright lives. Only the beloved Emperor would truly live forever. Loken tried to imagine the future, but the image would not form. Death would wipe them all from history. Not even the great first captain Ezekiel Abaddon would survive forever. There would be a time when Abaddon no longer waged war across the territories of humanity. Loken sighed. That would be a sad day indeed. Men would cry out for Abaddon's return, but he would never come. He tried to picture the manner of his own death. Fabled, imaginary combats flashed through his mind. He imagined himself at the Emperor's side, fighting some great last stand against an unknown foe. Primarch Horus would be there. He had to be. It wouldn't be the same without him. Loken would battle and die, and perhaps even Horus would die, to save the Emperor at the last. Then, briefly, he imagined another death, alone, far away from his comrades and his legion, dying from cruel wounds on some nameless rock, his passing as memorable as smoke. Loken swallowed hard. Either way, his service was to the Emperor, and his service would be true to the end. "The names are said," Abaddon intoned. "And of them we hail Sejanus, latest to fall." "Hail Sejanus!" Togadon and Axamon cried. "Gaviel Loken," Abaddon said, looking at Loken. "We ask you to take Sejanus's place. How say you?"
"I will do this thing gladly."
"Will you swear an oath to uphold the confraterne of the Morneval?"
"I will," said Loken.
"Your oath is taken. Gaviel, welcome into the Morneval. Tarek, illuminate us." Togadon pulled a vapor flare from his belt and fired it off into the night sky. It burst in a bright umbrella of harsh light. As the sparks of it rained slowly down onto the waters, the 4 warriors hugged and whooped, clasping hands and slapping backs. Togadon, Axamund, and Abaddon took turns to embrace Loken.
"You're one of us now,"
Togadon whispered as he drew Loken close.
"I am," said Loken.